The Guardian.
The UK has a problem, and it's not going away.
If you actually look at a periodic table, coloured in with all of the elements and nuclides that are present in nuclear waste, you cover possibly more than half of the periodic table. So it's actually a real smorgasbord of elements and isotopes.
The government have recently rebooted plans for a long-term solution to our toxic legacy.
Are we actually going to do this and deal with this issue once and for all, or are we going to leave it to a future generation?
With other countries moving ahead with their own solutions to their nuclear waste, is the UK ready to clean up its own inventory? Or will the revamped initiative prove to be just too toxic? This is Science Weekly. I'm Jeff Marsh. In order to navigate this hazardous topic, I invited The Guardian's energy correspondent, Adam Vaughan, to join me in the studio. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Firstly, is the issue of nuclear waste high up on people's agenda?
Nuclear waste is weirdly absent, I think, in the public discourse. It doesn't crop up very much. In fact, I was asked this question by a Dutch TV network recently because they are looking over there again about whether to restart nuclear. And for them, the nuclear waste thing had come up really in the foreground, and it was very much sort of the public concern. And I was asked, you know, is it not an issue here in the UK? And the frank answer was, it's not. You know, it's something that there were, obviously, you know, people like the CND and Greenpeace back in the sort of 90s and 80s made it very much a prominent issue. But it's funny, it's one of those things because it's out of sight, out of mind, I think, maybe to an extent. It's not really something that gets a lot of coverage, and it tends to only, really the only times we tend to discuss it are in recent years in this discussion of what to do in the long term.
Do you think that that constitutes a bit of a problem? I mean, to my mind, Britain's nuclear waste legacy is actually quite a pressing environmental issue.
I think it's a travesty, really, that we don't talk about it more. I think it's very convenient for the nuclear industry for it waste not really to be discussed very much, especially in the context of when we're having big policy discussions about future energy policy. And, you know, we've got this legacy, which we haven't worked out, frankly, how to deal with. We do need to do something about it. You know, we're talking about building a fleet of new nuclear power stations, maybe not, given recent news, as many as we thought we were going to have. But we don't even have an idea of what we're going to do with the old stuff, let alone what we might do with the new stuff.
Britain's nuclear legacy is a complicated one, and in part this is testament to our long history as pioneers of nuclear energy. But it does mean that we have a lot of radioactive waste, of different types and hazard levels, stored in different places all across the UK. It is, to put it frankly, a bit of a mess. And I think quite a complicated concept for people to get their heads around. Do you think people on the whole have a sense of what nuclear waste is?
I don't think people know what nuclear waste is, and I don't think people have any idea of, you know, where it might be stored, or, you know, all the different levels of hazardness. You know, you have low-level waste and then we have high-level waste, and that is maybe our fault as the media generally, we don't give that more coverage. I went to Sellafield fairly recently, and part of that was to try and convey to readers a little bit of the colour, a little bit of a flavour of what that was like.
For anyone who doesn't know, Sellafield is up in the north of England, and it's got the biggest store of spent nuclear fuel and other types of waste, right?
Yeah, so the UK has around about 30 different sites that store our nuclear waste. By far the biggest of those is Sellafield in West Cumbria. It's right on the coast, and it's the size of a town, really. There, the site is doesn't have any room to grow. It's hugely congested. It's split in two by the River Calder, and, you know, several thousand people work there, and it has its own police force. You know, it's because of the nature of some of the materials they have stockpiled there. They've got, you know, the world's biggest stockpile of plutonium, for example. The logic of doing something out of our nuclear waste becomes very evident when you go to Sellafield and you see that some of our existing potentially very hazardous waste is practically open to the elements. The only barrier between it and the rest of the world is some water in some cases in the oldest parts of the site.
So what exactly is nuclear waste? Well, the truth is it's lots of things, from low-level waste like the gloves used by researchers working with radioactive materials, to mechanical parts of decommissioned reactors, right through to smoking hot spent fuel rods and other high-level waste materials that can take hundreds of thousands of years to pacify their most dangerous content. In order to make sense of our nuclear waste, I spoke to Professor Polly Arnold, the Crum Brown Chair of Chemistry at the University of Edinburgh.
And I have a research group at the university, and we spend an awful lot of our time trying to make weird esoteric molecules from the metals at the bottom of the periodic table. So we want to study these metals at the bottom of the periodic table because we don't really know enough about their bonding and their behaviour, their chemical behaviour. And we think this is very important because they're all wrapped up in the nuclear waste challenge.
It's funny listening to you talk about this because you're obviously madly excited by these actually quite dangerous chemicals. There's a bit of a dark side to them, isn't there?
Oh, they're not dangerous. What's dangerous in my day is my walk to work past all the traffic. Yes, some of the reagents will catch fire. Some of them will give us nasty burns, but we're very careful. And what we're actually working with is the least radioactive of all of these metals in the bottom row of the table, or currently the bottom row of the table, I should say. So we work with uranium on a day-to-day basis and also thorium. And these are low-level alpha and a little bit of beta radioactivity emitters, and then they have a gamma dose as well. But we can protect ourselves from these by good lab practice.
Would you say that we have a uniquely complicated situation here in the UK?
Yeah, because the UK was such nuclear pioneers, we have a particularly complicated set of wastes. So at the beginning, every time we built a new nuclear reactor, it was exciting times and all of our reactors were a bit different. And that means, of course, that not just the fuels that we put into them were a bit different, but all of the wastes are different. And people will have done research experiments while they were running the reactors. So over the years, the form that the wastes have come out will have differences in them as well. So our waste legacy is significantly more complex in the UK than it is in some other countries. Although the Americans will probably share that same accolade as us.
So with over five decades of nuclear energy production, plus everything created from weaponry, research and medicine all thrown in, there's a lot of waste to deal with. But as Polly explains, some of it should cause us more concern than others.
So the interesting part, or the important part that we really need to be careful about curating, is the high-level waste, because this is stuff that we can't just let get released by accident. We have to be very careful. So this is spent fuel. So fuel pellets, when they start, they look like wine corks, I guess, of uranium oxide, or they might be a mixture of uranium and plutonium oxide. And those are stacked into tubes that make fuel rods. And when they've been burnt or spent, they swell because they're so hot and there are so many neutrons in the reaction that they get removed before they're fully burnt. So the spent fuel is about 96% unreacted uranium, about 1% plutonium, and about 3% of other waste products. So these will be minor actinides, which are the non-naturally occurring elements, those beyond uranium and plutonium, the ones that have been made during the fuel burning reactions. And they're made from neutron capture. And so they're generally unstable elements because they may have way too many or way too few neutrons, and then they're essentially poised to do that radioactive decay reaction because their nucleus is unstable. And they can be extremely high-level energy emitters when they decompose. There may be small amounts of these very, very radioactive components, but they are causing a significant headache. And it's a more complicated problem than this. So if you actually look at a periodic table coloured in with all of the elements and nuclides that are present in waste, you cover possibly more than half of the periodic table. So it's actually a real smorgasbord of elements and isotopes that have different lifetimes and different toxicities.
This might sound like a stupid question, Polly, but what is the main issue with this high-level waste? Why does it give you a headache?
Our concern with waste as it stands is that it is going to remain significantly radioactive and dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years.
So the picture doesn't look too pretty, does it? But fear not, the UK government has a solution to our long-lasting neutron-spewing legacy. And after the break, you'll hear my visit to the masterminds behind the plan.
There's no conceivable engineering solution that would last that long. But when you look at geology, geologists routinely sort of trade in billions of years and look back over billions of years. So the basic premise is that you would find a geological setting which has been stable enough, and you're confident will be stable enough for hundreds of thousands of years into the future and provide passive safety.
We'll also hear Polly Arnold's take on alternative fates for our nuclear waste.
That's the safe way to return the radioactivity of our spent fuel back to background radiation within a period of 1,000 years rather than hundreds of thousands of years.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off with the second half of the show and explore the work that needs to be done to clear up our messy nuclear legacy, I feel impelled to let you know about how The Guardian can help you with your work, whatever that may be. Luckily for me, I love doing what I do, sharing my excitement for science with the world and working with some really great companies along the way who share that enthusiasm. But not everyone's that fortunate. Thankfully, Guardian Jobs can help you find your good company. It promotes a world of work where potential flourishes by connecting people with rewarding careers at like-minded organisations, where values make the difference. It makes it easy to find roles that are relevant to your sector, location, and seniority level, so you can trust Guardian Jobs to help you find a role where you can make a difference for yourself and your employer. And if you're a recruiter looking to attract a diverse candidate pool who share progressive values and are engaged with the world around them, trust Guardian Jobs to help you fill your vacancies with people who want to make a difference. To find your good company, go to gu.com/good company. Now, back to the show. Hello again, welcome back to Science Weekly. So, in the first half, it was made fairly clear that despite it getting fairly little coverage, the UK's nuclear legacy is large, complex, and not going away, for hundreds of thousands of years anyway. The UK government's plan, which has gained support amongst several nuclear nations, is to bury it deep in the ground, where, with any luck, it will remain for the long haul. I went to a rather swanky hotel in central London to meet Bruce McCurdy and Anne McCall from Radioactive Waste Management Limited, who are spearheading the initiative to find a site for and build a geological disposal facility, or GDF.
Hi. Hello. Is that Bruce? I'm
Bruce. We left the noisy lobby, thankfully, and found a nice quiet room for a chat. So, well, first of all, nice and easy, if you could just introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Bruce McCurdy. I'm the Managing Director of Radioactive Waste Management Limited.
I'm Anne McCall. I'm the Siting and Engagement Director at Radioactive Waste Management Limited.
Okay, so we are a subsidiary company of the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, and the, which is the NDA. They were established to clean up the whole nuclear legacy. So our job specifically is to find a site for and develop a geological disposal facility, which will be the ultimate resting place for all of the radioactive waste that's been generated from a legacy of 50 or 60 years of nuclear activity in this country.
What is the theory behind a geological disposal facility?
Well, I suppose you start by looking at the waste that goes into it. So it's radioactive waste. It's come mainly from a nuclear energy program. Some of it has a very long half-life and can remain hazardous for hundreds of thousands of years. So the basis for the geological disposal facility is you need something that can be passively safe over those very long timescales. So there's no conceivable engineering solution that would last that long. But when you look at geology, geologists routinely sort of trade in billions of years and look back over billions of years. So the basic premise is that you would find a geological setting which has been stable enough and you're confident will be stable enough for hundreds of thousands of years into the future and provide passive safety.
Britain's nuclear legacy constitutes a real mix of different types of radioactive waste with different half-lives and from different industries. Is the idea that a geological disposal facility is a sort of one-size-fits-all for everything the UK needs to get out of sight?
Everything that requires geological disposal. So some of the shorter-lived radionuclides and some of the low-level waste doesn't require geological disposal. It won't remain hazardous for that long. But the aim is that for all of the other stuff, from all of the different reactor types, all of the different processes that have gone on in the UK, that we would be able to take them. So some of those materials have not yet been declared as waste. So separated plutonium and some of the oxide fuels are still on the bank balance books as assets, but if they were declared as waste, we need to know whether or not we could dispose of them safely.
Obviously, the question on everyone's mind, including my own, is about safety. Throwing all of our radioactive waste under our feet just instinctively doesn't sound safe. But thankfully, a GDF would be more sophisticated than just a hole in the ground.
The whole concept is based on multi-barrier containment system. So the first barrier is the waste and the waste package itself. So that's being developed at the moment. We're packaging waste, or we're advising waste producers how they can do that so that it's safe for the very long term in a disposal facility. The second barrier is the buffer that's put around it and the engineered barriers within the repository system. So that can be clay materials, it can be cement, so that can form a chemical barrier as well as a physical buffer that will retard radionuclides from escaping for the system. And then the third barrier is the natural barrier, which is the depth of rock between the facility and the surface. And that's the bit that provides the very long, you know, hundreds of thousands of years plus containment system.
Now, you are hoping that this thing will last up to sort of million years or something. How have you planned for the risks of, you know, movement of water, seismic movements? How do you plan that far ahead and guess at what might happen?
Well, we don't guess. We take very careful research and we apply that to modelling and look at what could happen. And you could say they're not even predictions. We look at all of the scenarios, all of the features and events and processes that could happen over that time period, and we model them and we put them into some big probabilistic analysis. But the very basic answer is that, you know, if you look at the geology, if you look at the rocks, we can find rocks that have been stable for billions of years. And so we're very confident that they will remain stable for the millions of years that we would like them to act as our containment system.
For people who are interested in this risk assessment and everything, is it kind of, is it out there? Can people go and look at this assessment and sort of judge the evidence for themselves?
Yeah, all of our research work, all of our modelling work, all of the safety case work that we do is available. It's scrutinised by regulators, it's scrutinised by the Committee for Radioactive Waste Management, it's available from our website, you can get in touch with us, we'll even come and speak to people about it. So yeah, it's all open, it's all transparent.
I suppose this is in contrast to a potentially different strategy, I think, being employed by Scotland, which is leaving it nearer the surface but monitoring it. Are they the sort of two stark choices that you're sort of left with, accessible but able to be monitored, or deep, deep, deep underground and you just cross your fingers and seal it up?
I think the thing that determines which of those two waste management solutions you go for is the nature of the waste itself. So it's inconceivable that you could dispose of the whole of the UK's radioactive waste from nuclear reactors in a shallow disposal facility or near surface.
Can I just jump in and ask why?
Well, because of the very long half-life. So the thing that determines the depth of a geological disposal facility, which we say is between 200 and 1,000 metres deep, 200 metres to deal with future glacial erosion across the surface to ensure that there's always 100 metres of cover, and 1,000 metres being the maximum depth, because that's the extent to which we have precedent practice of underground openings. And as you get deeper, you get higher temperatures and you get higher pressures, so things become more difficult. So hence that range. So if you go shallow, which is sort of tens of metres, you couldn't guarantee over the timescales that these wastes would remain hazardous, that the containment system would be there.
This hypothetical geological disposal facility would operate for between 50 to 100 years or thereabouts, continually taking in all of our current stockpile and any new waste generated over that time period. So it's going to be quite the undertaking, to say the least. And it's down to Anne McCall and her team to find a suitable location. What are you looking for then in terms of an area for a potential geological disposal facility?
We're looking for an area of geology which is stable in geological terms, with enough rock that would be able to house the tunnels and vaults for housing the radioactive waste.
For someone who hasn't seen a sort of geological map of the UK, does that limit you greatly, or how, you know, what does it look like under the UK surface?
the UK has quite a wide, varied geology. We have everything from hard rocks, we have clays, and we have sedimentary type rocks, which are salts and things like gypsum, etc., as evidenced by the fact that we've been mining in the UK for many, many years. So the UK geology is actually quite varied, and there are areas of the UK where we have got suitable rocks, such as hard rocks, clay type rocks, and also sedimentary rocks. So there is quite a lot of the UK area which is actually suitable geologically for a geological disposal facility.
Your task is finding somewhere that ticks two boxes: suitable geology and a community that's willing to house one of these facilities. How are you going about that process, and how's it going?
Well, the government has just launched a new policy just before Christmas on the 19th of December, and in Wales, the Welsh government launched their policy last week. So this is a relatively new process that's been launched, and it's got communities and consent-based process right at the heart of this this new approach. So as you say, it is about finding a suitable site with a willing community. So our task now that the policy is launched is to actually engage with communities and lots of different people, explain an awful lot about our project in terms of raising awareness. And our aim is to attract and retain communities that might want to engage with us and find out more about hosting what is a major infrastructure project and one of the biggest environmental protection projects that the UK will undertake over the next few decades.
So the search is on for a community with the right geology and the willingness to entertain a project of this scope. But as we've said, we've been here before. Back to Adam Vaughan.
For more than a decade, there's been a consensus amongst government and experts in the field that the best solution to Britain's nuclear waste legacy is a geological disposal facility of some sort. Now, the last big effort came to a climax in 2013, and that came only two councils had come forward to be the ones to, you know, hope to be the areas to possibly host a facility, and that was Copeland and Allerdale in West Cumbria, and that was Shepway in Kent. And Shepway eventually pulled out, and finally it came down to a vote by Cumbria County Council, and they rejected it. And that was basically the death knell for that stage. So the government at that point had to be seen to be going away and having a substantive look again, and there was various strategy papers that were published in between then and 2018, which is when the reboot came with the launch of this consultation, and that at the end of 2018 that was sort of formalised into a more, an even longer, several hundred pages long document from the government.
Do you see that as a sort of just a cynical rebrand, or do you think there were genuine lessons learnt, and that this new effort, they have learnt from the past, and there's more of a effort perhaps on engagement with these communities? What went wrong last time?
Well, I think what went wrong last time is, I mean, some people say that what went wrong last time was local politics. Some people say that they tied it to local elections that were coming up, and that the council that rejected it, so for sort of relatively petty, as some critics would say, local political reasons. I can't really speak to the veracity of that or not, but I mean, I think ultimately that community didn't want it, you know, as represented by the council there. I mean, it's worth saying, you know, that at a district level, the council was happy with it. At a county council level, they weren't. And so that was the end of it.
Would you say that there is anything substantively different about the approach being taken now by the RWM compared with their predecessors who, you know, as you've said, couldn't find an agreement?
One thing that is different is the money on the table. So, you know, there's the idea is that even in the earlier stages of when a community comes forward, they'd be looking at sharing in like about around £1 million a year. And that might go to, I don't know, it might be something as mundane as upgrading roads. It might be go into some sort of local skills fund or apprentices fund or something like that. And that figure can also grow. And as a group of people, community out, which is yet to be defined what that exactly is, then that can go up to about £2.5 million a year. So that is a noticeable difference. And, you know, that might not seem like much, but it depends, you know, how big the circle is drawn, obviously, in terms of what defines a community. And also when you throw in the sort of context of austerity, which arguably is the central government's fault, then, you know, that there is going to be local authorities who might look at this and go, well, that's a way to mean that we can still keep, you know, our statutory requirements, you know, whatever it is, social care, taking the bins away, whatever it is. They might see this as a, you know, an attractive new source of revenue, you know, so I think that is one thing that is substantially different, is the money on offer, and then also the backdrop of local authorities who are arguably even more desperate for cash than they were in 2013.
So there's money in it, and of course a 50 to 100 year engineering project of this size would obviously bring jobs along with it. And as Adam says, maybe in an age of austerity, financial incentives like that may tip the balance in favour of a yes vote this time round. If a community were to choose to give home to such a facility, and if the models are to be believed, they'd be involved in a construction touted to remain intact for a million plus years, which maybe is quite cool. But is that even necessary? We definitely need to find somewhere to contain our nuclear legacy, but for a million years, longer than any civilization's ever come close to surviving. Well, Polly Arnold mentioned a field of research aimed at reducing those mind-bendingly long containment periods. It's called partition and transmutation.
I think separating out the metals before we choose which ones to bury is the most sensible way to proceed. I think it's really important because then we can isolate some of the most radioactive isotopes and we can pacify those, and then we don't have to deal with them anymore. Once you've separated out the minor actinides that are extremely radioactive, very fissile and have very, very long lifetimes, you can put those in a specialist reactor and bombard them with neutrons and just tip them over the edge, and they will then fission in the way that the uranium did in the first place, and they will turn into other elements completely. So they will form two daughter products which won't have the extremely high radioactivity that they had. And we know how to do that. So separating them out, this is the partitioning part of partitioning and transmutation, and then that's the transmutation part. And so that's the safe way to return the radioactivity of our spent fuel back to background radiation within a period of 1,000 years rather than hundreds of thousands of years.
And give us a sense of how far along we are with the research effort for partitioning and transmutation.
The partitioning and transmutation research effort has been, in my opinion, underfunded over the years. It's not the sexiest part of research in general, because it's not making new energy and it's not making a biorenewable. But the moment you start talking about waste, people's eyes glaze over. So I have high hopes for it, but I see it as, yeah, not the sexiest thing around at the moment. But when I go into the community and we talk about what's going on, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on, and people are very committed, and they're really very hopeful for future successes in it.
So Polly would advocate separating out the nastiest content from our nuclear waste, blasting it with neutrons, and rendering it into something which requires containment for thousands as opposed to a million years. You could argue, I suppose, that time difference is of little consequence to a civilization now. But another reason for Polly's desire to sort this waste before burying it is that a lot of the products of fission are really valuable, and that, frankly, it's wasteful to bury it all underground, never to be seen again. I put this to Bruce and Anne.
Could you not, if you did try and separate out nuclear waste, save money and stop a geological disposal facility having to be a million years old rather than a few thousand years old?
So there is some scope to reduce the half-life and reduce the radiotoxicity of part of the inventory using partitioning and transmutation, but you can't get all of it, and there will always be a need for a geological disposal facility. So the approach in this country is that we're keeping a watching brief on the technology. It hasn't yet been done at an industrial scale. It's been done experimentally. And the real benefit of it would come in with new types of reactors that have it built into the whole fuel cycle, rather than trying to retrofit it to waste that have been generated. So you actually, as you generate the waste from a reactor, you generate the waste in such a way that you remove the most radiotoxic species.
And the only thing I'd add to that is that partition and transmutation requires you to partition the particular radionuclides that you need to reduce and target to change their composition. And the nature of the UK's radioactive waste and the way it's been generated over the last 50 or 60 years is that it is actually quite a complex set of radioactivity and set of other chemicals altogether. So the effort to actually segregate it, partition it effectively, so that you could use partition and transmutation would actually be quite significant and on quite a large scale.
It really seems like, you know, nuclear waste is, excuse the pun, but it's sort of politically toxic as well, isn't it? The challenge of Britain's nuclear waste, do you think it's more of a scientific one or more of a sort of political one?
The challenge of nuclear waste is primarily a political one. I think, you know, in terms of people I talk to, you know, the sort of technical and engineering solutions exist or can be conceived of. I think the real challenge is a political one of selling this to people and finding somewhere in the country that thinks that the investment and the jobs and it brings the area are as some people might put it, a price worth paying, you know, for having this underneath their feet.
Thank you to Polly Arnold from the University of Edinburgh and Bruce McCurdy and Anne McCall from Radioactive Waste Management Limited. And also a big thank you for some much-needed context by The Guardian's energy correspondent, Adam Vaughan. This week's episode was presented and produced by me, Jeff Marsh. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. Just email scienceweekly@theguardian.com. Thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.